The wind roared over the pure panic thundering in his heart. He planned to lose himself in the awakening sky while scouting for danger, to sort himself out before he returned to her, and started asking questions that he might not be ready to hear the answers to. But the coast appeared, and only his magic kept him from tumbling out of the sky at what the first rays of sun revealed. Broad sparkling rivers and snaking streams flowed throughout the undulating emerald and gold of the grasslands and reeds lining them, the burnt gold of the sandbanks flanking either side. And where little fishing villages had once watched over the sea, fire. Dozens of those villages burning. On the ship beneath him, the sailors began to shout, calling to one another as the coast at last broke over the horizon and the smoke became visible. Ilwe. Ilwe was burning. Chapter 49. Elide didn't speak to Lorkin for 3 days. She wouldn't have spoken to him for another 3, maybe for 3 damn months, if necessity hadn't required them to break their hateful silence. Her cycle had come, and through whatever steady, healthy diet she'd been consuming this past month, it had gone from an inconsistent trickle to the deluge she'd awoken to this morning. She'd hurtled from the narrow bed in the cabin to the small privy on board, rifled through every drawer and box she could find, but clearly a woman had never spent any time on this infernal boat. She resorted to ripping up the embroidered tablecloth for liners, and by the time she'd cleaned herself up, Lorkin was awake and already steering the boat. She said flatly to him, "I need supplies."
"You still reek of blood."
"I suspect I will reek of blood for several more days, and it will get worse before it gets better, so I need supplies. Now." He turned from his usual spot near the prow, sniffing once. Her face was burning, her stomach a knotted mess of cramping.
"I'll stop at the next town."
"When will that be?"
The map was of no use to her.
"By nightfall."
They'd sailed right through every town or outpost along the river, surviving on the fish Lorkin had caught. She'd been so annoyed at her own helplessness that after the first day, she'd started copying his movements, and had earned herself a fat trout in the process. She'd made him kill it and gut it and cook it, but she'd at least caught the thing. Elide said, "Fine."
Lorkin said, "Fine."
She aimed for the cabin to find some other fabrics to tide her over, but Lorkin said,
"You barely bled the last time."
The last thing she wanted to do was have this conversation. Perhaps my body finally felt safe enough to be normal. Because even with him murdering that man, lying and then spitting the truth about Aelin in her face, Lorkin would go up against any threat without a second thought. Perhaps for his own survival, but he'd promised her protection. She was able to sleep through the night because he lay on the floor between her and the door.
"So, there's nothing wrong, then?"
He didn't bother to look at her as he said it. But she cocked her head, studying the hard muscles of his back. Even while refusing to speak to him, she'd watched him, and made excuses to watch as he went through his exercises each day, usually shirtless. "No, there's nothing wrong," she said. At least she hoped. But Finula, her nursemaid, had always clicked her tongue and said her cycles were spotty, too light and irregular. For this one to have come precisely a month later? She didn't feel like wondering about it. Lorkin said,
"Good. It'd delay us if it were otherwise." She rolled her eyes at his back, not at all surprised by the answer, and limped into the cabin. He'd needed to stop anyway, Lorcan told himself, as he watched Elide barter with an innkeeper in town for the supplies she needed. She'd wrapped her dark hair in a discarded red kerchief she must have scrounged up on that pitiful little barge, and even used a nasally accent while she spoke to the woman, her entire countenance a far cry from the graceful, quiet woman he'd spent 3 days ignoring. Which had been fine. He'd used these 3 days to sort out his plans for Aelin Galathinius, how he'd return the favor she'd dealt him. The inn seemed safe enough, so Lorcan left a lead to her bartering. Turned out she wanted new clothes, too, and wandered the ramshackle streets of the backwater town in search of supplies. The streets were abuzz with river traders and fisher folk mooring for the night. Lorcan managed to intimidate his way into buying a crate of apples, dried venison, and some oats for half their usual price. Just to get him away, the mercher along the crumbling quay threw in a few pears. "For the lovely lady," he'd said. Lorcan, arms full of his wares, was almost to the barge when the words echoed in his head, an off-kilter peeling. He hadn't taken a lead past that section of the quay. Hadn't spied the man while he'd been docking, or when they'd left. Rumor could account for it, but this was a river town. Strangers were always coming and going, and paid for their anonymity. He hurried back to the barge. Fog had rippled in from the river, clouding the town and the opposite bank. By the time he dumped the crate and wares onto the boat, not even bothering to tie them down, the streets had emptied. His magic stirred. He scanned the fog, the splotches of gold where candles shone in windows. "Not right. Not right. Not right," his magic whispered. Where was she? "Hurry," he willed her, counting the blocks they'd taken to the inn. She should have been back by now. The fog pressed in. Squeaking sounded at his boots. Lorcan snarled at the cobblestones as rats streamed past, toward the water. They flung themselves into the river, crawling and clawing over one another. Something wasn't coming. Something was here. The innkeeper insisted she try on the clothes before she bought them. She bundled them in Elide's arms and pointed her toward a room in the back of the inn. Men stared at her, too eagerly, as she passed, and strode down a narrow hall. Typical of Lorcan to leave her while he sought whatever he needed. Elide shoved into the room, finding it black and chilled. She twisted, scanning for a candle and flint. The door snapped shut, sealing her in. Elide lunged for the handle as that little voice whispered, "Run, run, 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 run!" She slammed into something muscled, bony, and leathery. It reeked of spoiled meat and old blood. A candle sparked to life across the room, revealing a wooden table, an empty hearth, sealed windows, and Vernon, sitting on the other side of the table, smiling at her like a cat. Strong hands tipped in claws clamped on her shoulders, nails cutting through her leathers. The Ilken held her firmly, as her uncle drawled, "What an adventure you've had, Elide." Chapter 50.
"How did you find me?"
Elide breathed, the reek of the Ilken nearly enough to make her vomit. Her uncle rose to his feet in a fluid, unhurried movement, straightening his green tunic.
"Asking questions to buy yourself time. Clever, but expected."
He jerked his chin to the creature. It loosed a low, guttural clicking sound. The door opened behind it, revealing two other Ilken now crowding the hall with their wings and hideous faces. Oh, gods.
Oh, gods. Think, 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 think.
Your companion, last we heard, was putting supplies on his boat and unmooring it. You probably should have paid him more.
He's my husband, she hissed. You have no right to take me from him. None.
Because once she was married, Vernon's wardenship over her life ended. Vernon let out a low laugh.
Lorcan Salvatore, Maeve's second-in-command, is your husband? Really, Elide?
He waved a lazy hand to the Ilken.
We depart now.
Fight. Now. Now, before they had the chance to move her, to get her away. But where to run? The innkeeper had sold her out. Someone had betrayed their location on this river.
The Ilken tugged at her. She planted her heels onto the wooden slats. Little good it would do.
It let out a low laugh and brought its mouth to her ear.
Your blood smells clean.
She recoiled, but it gripped her hard, its grayish tongue tickling the side of her neck. Thrashing, she still could do nothing as it twisted them into the hall and toward the two waiting Ilken in it. To the back door, not 10 feet away, already open to the night beyond.
You see what I shielded you from at Morath, Elide,
Vernon crooned, falling into step behind them. She slammed her feet into the wooden floor, over and over, straining for the wall, for anything to have leverage to push and fight against it.
No. No. No.
Lorcan had left. He'd gotten everything he needed from her, and left. She'd slowed him down, had brought enemy after enemy after him.
And whatever will you do back at Morath?
Vernon mused, now that Manon Blackbeak is dead. Elide's chest cracked open at the words.
Manon.
Gutted by her own grandmother and thrown off the side of the keep for her disobedience. Of course, I'll shield you from your relatives, but Erewhon will be interested to learn what you've been up to. What you took from Kaltain.
The stone in her jacket's breast pocket. It thrummed and whispered, awakening as she bucked. No one in the now silent inn at the opposite end of the hall bothered to come around the corner and investigate her wordless shouting. Another Ilken stepped into view just beyond the open back door. 4 of them. And Lorcan had left. The stone at her breast began to seethe. But a voice that was young and old, wise and sweet, whispered, "Do not touch it. Do not use it. Do not acknowledge it." It had been inside Kaltain, had driven her mad, had made her into that shell. A shell for something else to fill. The open door loomed.
Think, think, think!
She couldn't breathe enough to think, the Ilken reek around her promising the sort of horrors she'd endure when they got her back to Morath. No, she wouldn't go. She wouldn't let them take her, break and use her. One shot. She'd have one shot.
No,
whispered the voice in her head.
No.
But there was a knife at her uncle's side as he strolled ahead and out the door. It was all she'd need. She'd seen Lorcan do it enough while hunting. Vernon paused in the back courtyard. A large rectangular iron box waiting before him. There was a small window in it, and handles on 2 of its edges. She knew what the Ilken were for as the 3 others fell into place around it. They'd shove her inside, lock the door, and fly her back to Morath. The box was a little bigger than a coffin standing upright. Its door was already open. The Ilken would have to release her to throw her inside. For a heartbeat, they'd let go.
She'd have to use it to her advantage. Vernon loitered beside the box. She didn't dare look at his knife. A sob broke from her throat. She'd die here, in this filthy courtyard, with these awful things around her. She'd never see the sun again, or laugh, or hear music. The Ilken stirred around the box, wings rustling. 5 feet. 4. 3. No, 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 the wise voice begged her. She would not be taken back to Morath. She would not let them touch her and corrupt her. The Ilken shoved her forward, a violent thrust meant to send her staggering into the box. Elide twisted, slamming face first into the edge instead, her nose crunching. But she whirled on her uncle. Her ankle roared as she set her weight on it to lunge for the knife at his side. Vernon didn't have time to realize what she intended as she whipped the knife free from its sheath at his hip. As she flipped the knife in her fingers, her other hand wrapping around the hilt. As her shoulders curved inward, her chest caving, and she drove the blade home. Lorcan had the kill shot. Hidden in the fog, the four Ilken couldn't detect him, as the man he was certain was Elide's uncle had that Ilken haul her toward that prison box. It was on him that Lorcan had trained his hatchet. Elide was sobbing, in terror and despair. Each sound whetted his rage into something so lethal Lorcan could barely see straight. Then the Ilken threw her into that iron box. And Elide proved she wasn't bluffing in her claim to never return to Morath. He heard her nose break as she hit the rim of the box, heard her uncle's cry of surprise as she rebounded and lunged for him, and grabbed his dagger. Not to kill him. For the first time in 5 centuries, Lorcan knew true fear. As Elide turned that knife on herself, the blade angled to plunge up and into her heart. He threw his hatchet. As the tip of that dagger pierced the leather over her ribs, the wooden handle of his hatchet slammed into her wrist. Elide went down with a cry, the dagger flying wide. Lorcan was already moving as they whirled toward where he'd perched on the rooftop. He leaped to the nearest one, to the weapons he'd positioned there minutes before, knowing they'd emerge from this door. His next knife went through the wing of an Ilken, then another to keep it down before they pinpointed his location. But Lorcan was already sprinting to the third rooftop flanking the courtyard, to the sword he'd left there. He hurled it right through the face of the closest one. 2 left, along with Vernon, screaming now to get the girl in the box. Elide was running like hell for the narrow alley out of the courtyard, not the broad street. The alley, too small for the Ilken to fit, especially with all the debris and trash littered throughout. Good girl. Lorcan leaped and rolled onto the next roof, to the 2 remaining daggers. He threw them, but the Ilken had already learned his aim, his throwing style. They hadn't learned Elide's. She hadn't just gone into the alley to save herself. She'd gone after the hatchet. And Lorcan watched as that woman crept up behind the distracted Ilken and drove the hatchet into its wings. With an injured wrist, with her nose leaking blood down her face. The Ilken screamed, thrashing to grab her, even as it crashed to its knees, where she wanted it. The axe was swinging again before its scream finished sounding. The sound was cut off a heartbeat later, as its head bounced to the stones. Lorcan hurtled off the roof, aiming for the 1 remaining Ilken now seething at her. But it pivoted and ran to where Vernon was cowering by the door, his face bloodless. Sobbing, her own blood sprayed on the stones. Elide whirled toward her uncle, too, axe already lifting. But the Ilken reached her uncle, snatched him up in its strong arms, and launched them both into the sky. Elide threw the hatchet anyway. It missed the Ilken's wing by a whisper of wind. The axe slammed into the cobblestones, taking out a chunk of rock. Right near the Ilkin with the shredded wings, now crawling toward the courtyard exit. Lorcan watched as Elide picked up his axe and walked toward the hissing, broken beast. It lashed at her with its claws. Elide easily sidestepped the swipe. It screamed as she stomped on its wrecked wing, halting its crawl to freedom. When it fell silent, she said in a quiet, merciless voice he'd never heard her use, clear despite the blood clogging one nostril.
I want Erewhon to know that the next time he sends you after me like a pack of dogs, I'll return the favor. I want Erewhon to know that the next time I see him, I will carve Manon's name on his god's damned heart.
Tears rolled down her face, silent and unending, as the wrath that now sculpted her features into a thing of mighty and terrible beauty.
But it seems like tonight isn't really your night,
Elide said to the Ilkin, lifting the hatchet again over a shoulder. The Ilkin might have been whimpering as she smiled grimly.
Because it takes only one to deliver a message, and your companions are already on their way.
The axe fell. Flesh and bone and blood spilled onto the stones. She stood there, staring at the corpse, at the reeking blood that dribbled from its neck. Lorcan, perhaps a bit numbly, walked over and took the axe from her hands. How she'd been able to use it with the sore wrist. She hissed and whimpered at the movement, as if whatever force had rushed through her blood had vanished, leaving only pain behind. She clutched her wrist, utterly silent, as he circled the dead Ilkin and severed their heads from their bodies, one after another, retrieving his weapons as he went. People inside the inn were stirring, wondering at the noise, wondering if it was safe to come out to see what had happened to the girl they'd so willingly betrayed. For a heartbeat, Lorcan debated ending that innkeeper. But Elide said,
"Enough, death."
Tears streaked through the splattered black blood on her cheeks, blood that was a mockery of the smattering of freckles. Blood, crimson and pure, ran from her nose down her mouth and chin, already caking. So he sheathed the hatchet and scooped her into his arms. She didn't object. He carried her through the fog-wrapped town to where their boat was tied. Already onlookers had gathered, no doubt to scavenge their supplies when the Ilkin left. A snarl from Lorcan had them skittering into the mist. As he stepped onto the barge, the boat rocking beneath him, Elide said,
"He told me you'd left."
Lorcan still didn't set her down, holding her aloft with one arm as he untied the ropes.
"You believed him."
She wiped at the blood on her face, then winced at the tender wrist and broken nose. He'd have to tend to that. Even then, it might very well be slightly crooked forever. He doubted she'd care. Knew she'd perhaps see that crooked nose as a sign that she'd fought and survived. Lorcan put her down at last, atop the crate of apples, right where he could see her. She sat silently, as he took up the pole and pushed them away from the dock, from that hateful town, glad for the cover of mist as they drifted downstream. They could perhaps afford two more days on the river before they'd have to cut inland to shake any enemies trailing them. Good thing they were close enough to Eelway now to make it in a matter of days on foot. When there was nothing but wafting mist and the lapping of the river against the boat, Lorcan spoke again.
"You wouldn't have stopped that dagger."
She didn't respond. And the silence went on long enough that he turned to where she perched on the crate, Tears rolled down her face as she stared at the water. He didn't know how to comfort, how to soothe, not in the way she needed. So he set down the pole and sat beside her on the crate, the wood groaning.
Who is Manon?
He'd heard most of what Vernon had hissed inside that private dining room while he'd been setting his trap in the courtyard, but some details had evaded him.
The wing leader of the Iron Teeth Legion,
Elide said, voice trembling, the words snagging on the blood clogging her nose. Lorcan took a shot in the dark.
She was the one who got you out. That day. She was why you're in Witch Leathers. Why you wound up wandering in Oakwald.
A nod.
And Keltaine. Who was she?
The person who'd given her that thing she carried.
Erewhon's mistress. His slave. She was my age. He put the stone inside her arm and made her into a living ghost. She bought me and Manon time to run. She incinerated most of Morath in the process, and herself.
Elide reached into her jacket, her breathing thick with tears still sliding down her face. Lorcan's breath caught as she pulled out a scrap of dark fabric. The scent clinging to it was female. Foreign, broken and sad and cold. But there was another scent beneath it, one he knew and hated.
Keltaine said to give this to Selena, not to Aelin,
Elide said, shaking with her tears.
Because Selena, she gave her a warm cloak in a cold dungeon, and they wouldn't let Keltaine take the cloak with her when they brought her to Morath. But she managed to save this scrap. To remember to repay Selena for that kindness. But what sort of gift is this thing? What is this?
She pulled back the fold of cloth, revealing a dark sliver of stone. Every drop of blood in his body went cold and hot, awake and dead. She was sobbing quietly.
Why is this payment? My very bones say to not touch it. A voice told me not to even think about it.
It was wrong. The thing in her beautiful, filthy hand was wrong. It did not belong here. Should not be here. The god who had watched over him his whole life had recoiled. Even death feared it.
Put it away, he said roughly. Right now.
Hand shaking, she did so. Only when it was hidden inside her jacket did he say,
Let's clean you up first. Set that nose and wrist. I'll tell you what I know while I do.
She nodded, gaze on the river. Lorcan reached out, grasping her chin and forcing her to look at him. Hopeless, bleak eyes met his. He brushed away a stray tear with his thumb.
I made a promise to protect you. I will not break it, Elide.
She made to pull away, but he gripped her a little harder, keeping her eyes on him.
I will always find you,
he swore to her. Her throat bobbed. Lorcan whispered,
I promise.
Elide sifted through all Lorcan had told her while he cleaned her face, inspected her nose and wrist, bound the latter in soft cloth, and quickly but not viciously set her nose. Word keys. Word gates. Aelin had one word key, was looking for the other two. Soon to be only one more once Elide gave her the key she carried. Two keys. Against one. Perhaps they would win this war. even if Elide didn't know how Aelin could use them and not destroy herself. But she'd leave it up to her. Erewhon might have the armies, but if Aelin had two keys... She tried not to think about Manon. Vernon had lied about Lorkin leaving, to break her spirit, to get her to come willingly. Perhaps Manon was not dead either. She wouldn't believe it until she had proof, until the whole world screamed at her that the wing leader was gone. Lorkin was back at the prow by the time she'd changed into one of his own shirts while her leathers dried. Her wrist throbbed, a dull, insistent ache. Her face was no better, and Lorkin had promised she'd likely have a black eye from it, but her head was clear. She came up beside him, watching him push the pole against the mucky bottom of the river.
I killed those things.
You did a fine job of it, he said.
I don't regret it.
Dark, depthless eyes slid to her.
Good.
She didn't know why she said it, why she felt a need, or like it was worth anything to him at all. But Elide stood on her toes, kissed his stubble rough cheek, and said,
I will always find you too, Lorkin.
She felt him staring at her, even when she'd climbed into bed minutes later. When she awoke, clean strips of linen for her cycle were next to the bed. His own shirt, washed and dried overnight, now cut up for her to use as she would. Chapter 51 Eowei's coast was burning. For 3 days they sailed past village after village, some still burning, some only cinders. And at each of them, Aelin and Rowan had labored to put out those flames. Rowan in his hawk form could fly in, but it killed her. Absolutely killed her that they could not afford to halt long enough to go to shore. So she did it from the ship, burrowing deep into her power, stretching it as far as it could go across sea and sky and sand, to wink out those fires one by one. By the end of the 3rd day, she was flagging, so thirsty that no amount of water was able to slake it, her lips chapped and peeling. Rowan had gone to shore 3 times now to ask who had done it. Each time the answer was the same. Darkness had swept over them in the night, the kind that blotted out the stars, and then the villages were burning beneath flaming arrows not spotted until they had found their targets. But where that darkness, where Erewhon's forces were, there was no sign of them. No sign of Maeve, either. Rowan and Lysandra had flown high and wide, searching for either force, but nothing. Ghosts, some villagers were now claiming, had attacked them. The ghosts of their unburied dead, raging home from distant lands. Until they started whispering another rumor. That Aelin Galathinius herself was burning Eowei, village by village, for vengeance that they had not aided her kingdom 10 years ago. No matter that she was putting out the flames. They did not believe Rowan when he tried to explain who soothed their fires from aboard the distant ship. He told her not to listen, not to let it sink in. So she tried. And it had been during one of those times that Rowan had run his thumb over the scar of her palm, leaning to kiss her neck. He'd breathed her in, and she knew he detected an answer to the question that had caused him to flee that morning on the ship. No. She was not carrying his child. They had only discussed the matter once, last week, when she'd crawled off him, panting and coated in sweat, and he'd asked if she was taking a tonic. She merely told him no. He'd gone still. And then she had explained that if she'd inherited so much of Mab's Fey blood,
She might very well have inherited the Fae's struggle to conceive. And even if the timing was horrible, if this was to be the one shot she had of providing Terrasen a bloodline, a future, she would not waste it. His green eyes turned distant, but he'd nodded, kissing her shoulder. And that had been that. She hadn't mustered the nerve to ask if he wanted to sire her children. If he wanted to have children, given what had happened to Lyria. And during that brief moment before he'd flown back to shore to put out more flames, she hadn't possessed the nerve to explain why she'd hurled her guts up that morning, either. The past 3 days had been a blur. From the moment Fenris had uttered those words, "Nameless is my price," everything had been a blur of smoke and flame and waves and sun. But as the sun set on the third day, Aelin again shoved those thoughts away as the escort ship began signaling ahead, the crew frantically working to drop anchor. Sweat beaded on her brow, her tongue parchment dry. But she forgot her thirst, her exhaustion, as she beheld what Rolf's men had spied moments ago. A flat, waterlogged land under a cloudy sky spread inland as far as the eye could see. Moldy green and bone-white grasses crested the bumps and hollows, little islands of life among the mirror-smooth gray water between them. And among them all, jutting up from brackish water and humped land like the limbs of an ill-buried corpse, ruins. Great, crumbling ruins. A once lovely city drowned on the plain. The Stone Marshes. Manon let the humans and Fae meet with the captains of the other two ships. She heard the news soon enough. What they sought lay about a day and a half inland. Precisely where, they didn't know, or how long it'd take to find its exact location. Until they returned, the ships would remain anchored here. And Manon, it seemed, would join them on their trip inland, as if the Queen suspected that if she were left behind, their little fleet would not be intact when they returned. Clever woman. But that was the other problem. The one facing Manon right now, already looking anxious and put out. Abraxos's tail lashed a bit, the iron spikes scraping and scratching the pristine ship deck, as if he'd heard the Queen's order a minute ago. The Wyvern has to go. On the flat, open expanses of the marshes, he'd be too noticeable. Manon placed a hand on his scarred snout, meeting those depthless black eyes. You need to lie low somewhere. A warm, sorrowful huff into her palm. Don't whine about it, Manon said, even as something twisted and roiled in her belly. Stay out of sight, keep alert, and come back in 4 days' time. She allowed herself to lean forward, resting her brow against his snout. His growl rumbled her bones. We've been a pair, you and I. A few days is nothing, my friend. He nudged her head with his own. Manon swallowed hard. You saved my life, many times. I never thanked you for it. Abraxos let out another low whine. You and me, she promised him, from now until the darkness claims us. She made herself pull away, made herself stroke his snout just once more, then back to step, then another. Go. He didn't move. She bared her iron teeth. Go. Abraxos gave her a look full of reproach, but his body tensed, wings lifting. And Manon decided she had never hated anyone more than she hated the Queen of Terrasen and her friends. For making him leave. For causing this parting, when so many dangers had not been able to cleave them.
But Abraxos was airborne, the sails groaning in the wind of his wings. And Manon watched until he was a speck on the horizon, until the longboats were being readied to bring them to the high grasses and stagnant gray water of the marshes beyond. The queen and her court readied, donning weapons like some people adorned themselves with jewelry, moving about in question and answer to one another. So similar to her 13. Similar enough that she had to turn away, ducking into the shadows of the foremast and schooling her breathing into an even rhythm. Her hands trembled. Asterin was not dead. The 13 were not dead. She'd kept the thoughts about it at bay. But now, with that flower-smelling wyvern vanishing over the horizon, the last piece of the wingleader had vanished with him. A muggy wind tugged her inland, toward those marshes, dragging her red cape with it. Manon ran a finger down the crimson cloak she'd made herself wear this morning. Rhiannon. She'd never heard a whisper that the Kraken royal bloodline had walked off that final killing field 5 centuries ago. She wondered if any of the Krakens beyond her half-sister knew the child of Lothian Blackbeak and a Kraken prince had survived. Manon unfastened the brooch, clasping the cloak at her shoulders. She weighed the thick bolt of red fabric in her hands. A few easy swipes of her nails had her clutching a long, thin strip of the cloak. A few more motions had her tying it around the end of her braid, the red stark against the moon white of her hair. Manon stepped out of the shadows behind the foremast and peered over the edge of the ship. No one commented when she dumped her half-sister's cloak into the sea. The wind carried it a few feet over the waves before it fluttered like a dying leaf to land atop the swells. A pool of blood. That's how it looked from the distance as the tide carried it out, out, out into the ocean. She found the King of Otterlin and Queen of Terrasen waiting at the railing of the main deck, their companions climbing into the awaiting longboat bobbing on the waves. She met eyes of sapphire, then those of turquoise and gold. She knew they'd seen it. Perhaps not understood what the cloak had meant, but understood the gesture for what it was. Manon flicked her iron teeth and nails back into their slits as she approached them. Aelin Galathinius said quietly, "You never stop seeing their faces." It was only when they were rowing for the shore, spindrift soaking them, that Manon realized the queen hadn't meant the 13. And Manon wondered if Aelin, too, had washed that cloak floating out to sea, and thought it looked like spilled blood. Chapter 52. They didn't get to Lareba, or to Banjali. They didn't even get close. Lorcan felt the push on his shoulder that had guided and shaped the course of his life, that invisible, insistent hand of shadow and death. So they went south, then west, sailing swiftly down the network of waterways through Eelway. Elid didn't object or question when he explained that if Hellas himself was nudging him, that the queen they hunted was likely in that direction, wherever it would lead. There were no cities out there, only endless grasslands that skirted Oakwald's southernmost tip, then marshes. The abandoned peninsula full of ruins among the marshes. But if that was where he was told to go... The dark god's touch on his shoulder had never steered him wrong, so he'd see what he'd find. He did not let himself dwell too long on the fact that Elid carried a word key, that she was trying to bring it to his enemy. Perhaps his power's summons would lead them both to it. To her... And then he'd have 2 keys, if he played his cards right. if he was smarter and faster and more ruthless than the others. Then, the most dangerous part of all, traveling with two keys in his possession into the heart of Morath to hunt down a third. Speed would be his best ally, and only shot at survival. And he'd likely never see Elid or any of the others again. They'd at last abandoned their barge that morning, cramming whatever supplies would fit into their packs before setting off through the rippling grasses. Hours later, Elid's breathing was ragged as they ascended a steep hill deep in the plain. He'd been scenting brine for 2 days now. They had to be close to the edge of the marshes. Elid swallowed hard, and he passed through the canteen as they crested the summit of the hill. But Elid halted, arms slackening at her sides. And Lorcan himself froze at what spread before them.
"What is this place?"
Elid breathed, as if fearful the land itself would hear. As far as the eye could see, flowing into the horizon, the land had sunk a good 30 feet, a severe, brutal crack from the edge of the cliff, not hill, on which they stood, as if some furious god had stomped a foot across the plain and left an imprint. Silvery, brackish water covered most of it, still as a mirror, interrupted only by grassy islands and mounds of earth, and crumbling, exquisite ruins.
"This is a bad place," Elid whispered. "We shouldn't be here."
Indeed, the hair on his arms had risen, every instinct on alert as he scanned the marshes, the ruins, the brambles, and thick foliage that had choked some of the islands. Even the god of death halted his nudging and ducked behind Lorcan's shoulder.
"What do you sense?"
Her lips were bloodless.
"Silence. Life, but such silence. As if..."
"As if what?"
He pushed. Her words were a shudder of breath.
"As if all the people who once lived here long ago are still trapped inside. Still beneath."
She pointed to a ruin, a curved, broken dome of what had likely been a ballroom attached to the spire, a palace.
"I don't think this is a place for the living, Lorcan. The beasts in these waters, I do not think they tolerate trespassers, nor do the dead."
"Is it the stone or the goddess who watches you telling you such things?"
"It's my heart that murmurs a warning. Aneth is silent. I don't think she wants to be anywhere near. I don't think she will follow."
"She came to Morath, but not here?"
"What is inside these marshes?"
she asked instead.
"Why is Aelin headed into them?"
That, it seemed, was the question. For if they picked up on it, surely the Queen and Whitethorn would sense it too, and only a great reward or threat would drive them here.
"I don't know,"
he admitted.
"No towns or outposts exist anywhere nearby."
Yet this was where the dark god had led him, and where that hand still pushed him to venture, even if it quaked. Nothing but ruins and dense foliage on those two small islands of safety, from whatever dwelled beneath the glassy water. But Lorcan obeyed the nudging god at his shoulder, and led the Lady of Peranth onward.
"Who lived here?"
Elid asked, staring at the weather-worn face of the statue jutting from a near-collapsed stone wall. It teetered on the outer edge of the little island they were standing on, and the moss-speckled woman carved there had no doubt once been beautiful, as well as a bit of support for beams and a roof that had since rotted away. but the veil she'd been carved wearing now seemed like a death shroud. Elide shivered.
This place was forgotten and wrecked centuries before I was even born,
Lorcan said. Did it belong to Eelwe?
It was a part of a kingdom that is now gone, a lost people who wandered and merged with those of different lands.
They must have been very talented to have made such beautiful buildings.
Lorcan grunted in agreement. It had been 2 days of inching across the marshes. No sign of Aelin. They had slept in the shelter of the ruins, though neither of them really got true rest. Elide's dreams had been filled with the pale, milky-eyed faces of people she'd never met, crying out in supplication as water shoved down their throats, their noses. Even waking, she could see them, hear their cries on the wind. Just the breeze through the stones, Lorcan grumbled that first day. But she'd seen it in his eyes. He heard the dead, too. Heard the thunder of the cataclysm that had dropped the land right from underneath them. Heard the rushing water that devoured them all before they could run. Curious beasts from sea and swamp and river had converged in the years following, making the ruins a hunting ground, feasting on one another when the waterlogged corpses ran out. Changing. Adapting. Growing fatter and cleverer than their ancestors had been. It was thanks to those beasts that it took so long to cross the marshes. Lorcan would scan the too still water between those islands of safety. Sometimes it was clear to wade through the chest-deep, salty water. Sometimes it was not. Sometimes even the islands were not safe. Twice now, she'd spotted a long, scaled tail, plated like armor, sliding behind a stone wall or broken pillar. Thrice she'd seen great golden eyes slitted down the pupil, watching from the reeds. Lorcan had hauled her over a shoulder and run whenever they realized they were not alone. Then there were the snakes, who liked to dangle from the wraith-like trees draining an existence from the islands. And the incessant biting midges, who were nothing compared to the clouds of mosquitoes that sometimes hounded them for hours. Or until Lorcan sent a wave of his dark power into them, and they all dropped to the earth in a dark rain. But every time he killed, she felt the earth shudder. Not in fear of him, but as if it were awakening. Listening. Wondering who dared walk across it. On the fourth night, Elide was so tired, so on edge, she wanted to whimper as they curled into a rare sanctuary. A ruined hall, with part of its mezzanine intact. It was open to the sky, and vines choked the three walls. But the stone stair had been solid, and was high enough off the island that nothing might crawl out of the water to prey upon them. Lorcan had rigged the base and top of the stairs with tripwires of vines and branches, to alert them if any beasts slithered up the steps. They didn't dare risk a fire, but it was warm enough that she didn't miss one. Lying beside Lorcan, his body a solid wall between her and the stone to her left, Elide watched the flickering stars, the drowsy buzz of insects a constant drone in her ears. Something roared in the distance. The insects paused. The marsh seemed to turn its attention toward that feral, deep roar. Slowly, life resumed again, though quieter. Lorcan murmured, "Sleep, Elide." She swallowed, her fear thick in her blood.
What was that?
One of the beasts. Either a mating call or a territorial warning.
She didn't want to know how big they were. Glimpses of eyes and tails were enough. Tell me about her, Elide whispered.
Your queen.
I doubt it'll help you sleep any better.
She turned onto her other side, finding him lying on his back, watching the sky.
Will she truly kill you for what you've done?
A nod.
Yet you risk it. For her sake.
She propped her head up with a fist.
Do you love her?
Those eyes, darker than the gaps between the stars, slid to her.
I have been in love with Maeve since I first laid eyes on her.
Are you her lover?
She had not dared ask it, hadn't really wanted to know.
No. I offered once. She laughed at me for the insolence.
His mouth tightened.
So I have made myself invaluable in other ways.
Again, that roar in the distance that silenced the world for a few heartbeats.
Was it closer? Or had she imagined it?
When she glanced back at him, Lorkin's eyes were on her mouth. She said,
Perhaps she uses your love to her own advantage.
Perhaps it's in her best interest to drag you along.
Maybe she'll change her mind when you seem the most likely to leave.
I am bloodsworn to her. I will never leave.
Her chest hurt at that.
Then she can rest assured knowing you'll pine after her for eternity.
The words came out sharper than she intended, and she made to look at the stars, but Lorkin gripped her chin, faster than she could detect. He peered into her eyes, scanning them.
Do not make the mistake of believing me to be a romantic fool. I do not hold any shred of hope for her.
Then that does not seem like love at all.
And what do you know of love?
He was so close, had neared without her realizing it.
I think love should make you happy,
Elide said, remembering her mother and father. How often they had smiled and laughed, how they had gazed at each other.
It should make you into the best possible version of yourself.
Are you implying I am neither of those things?
I don't think you even know what happiness is.
His face grew grave, thoughtful.
I do not mind being around you.
Is that a compliment?
A half-smile cut across his granite-hewn face, and she wanted
to touch it.
That smile, that mouth, with her fingers, her own lips. It made him younger, made him handsome. So she reached up with trembling fingers and touched his lips. Lorkin froze, still half above her, his eyes solemn and intent. But she traced the contours of his mouth, finding the skin there soft and warm. Such a contrast to the harsh words that usually came out of it. She reached the outer corner of his lips, and he turned his face into her hand, resting his rough cheek against her palm. His eyes grew heavy-lidded as she brushed a thumb over the hard plane of his cheekbone. Elide whispered,
I would hide you, in Peranth, if you do what you need to do and need somewhere to go, you would have a place there. With me.
His eyes snapped open. But there was nothing hard, nothing cold about the light shining in them.
I would be a dishonored male. It'd reflect poorly upon you.
If anyone thinks that, they would have no place in Peranth.
His throat bobbed. Elide, you need to...
But she rose up slightly, replacing her mouth where her fingers had been. The kiss was soft, and quiet, and brief. Barely a grazing of her lips against his. She thought Lorcan might have been trembling as she pulled back.